Well, it's great to be here this evening. It's been another beautiful day in this stream, and so it's a glorious day to be alive. As always, I hope that our study tonight will be edifying for everyone. Unlike what the slide says,
it's 1 Peter 5, not chapter 4. I'd like to thank Trace for reading that due to the slide mishap and handling that well. We're finally closing out 1 Peter. It's been a journey. It's been a very great journey. Many things that Peter has to say culminate here in this chapter. We get to the meaning of why he wrote this letter. And so we have some great things to look forward to studying tonight. Lauren, if I'm not wrong, I had the last question, which means
the first question would then be for Cole,
which is, it's four parts. What does it look like for us to submit to elders? How is it possible for everyone to be submissive to one another? What is Christian humility? And what verses are being quoted here, if you'd like to have?
So, submitting to elders just means being not quarrelsome, but obedient, even if the elders might be quarrelsome or loud and obnoxious. You just need to submit. So how is it possible to just not be quarrelsome with one another, but to be of one mind, to not be argumentative and split with one another, but to have each other's interest at heart and serve one another? And what is Christian humility? It's not to be self-deprecating, but it's to know your place and to know that we all are very flawed, that we all make some big mistakes, and that we are all so inferior compared to the Creator that whatever small inferiorities between us don't really mean much, as in like a hierarchy between us. And what verses are being quoted? One is Proverbs 3, verse 34, which says, "Surely he scorns the scornful, but gives grace to the humble." So, there you have it.
Thank you. Some very good answers. To part A, I'll just go ahead and give this verse. I thought of, obviously, the verses that Peter had given us in chapter 2 about being submissive. And especially 1 Peter 2, verse 17. "Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." And I thought, that is how we are to submit to our elders. Even if, you know, as we talked about last time, even if they're lording it over when they're not supposed to be, even if, like Cole said, they're being loud, perhaps obnoxious, we're to submit to them. Any other brother have a comment on this question? Lauren?
The part B, how is it possible for everyone to be submissive to one another? I kind of wondered if Peter was thinking about when Jesus washed the disciples' feet. We see this in John 13, verses 6 to 7. "Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, 'Lord, are you washing my feet?' And Jesus answered and said to him, 'What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this.'" I was wondering if that was one of the thoughts.
Yeah, I don't think Peter might have been thinking about this, but I thought about this. I thought of 2 Philippians 5 through 8. Speaking of humility, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even to the death of the cross." Bill?
Well, my study Bible, the writer wrote submission is a fundamental attitude of spiritual maturity. I thought that was kind of interesting and thought-provoking. That would maybe be part A, that submission is a fundamental attitude of spiritual maturity. But then you got to ask yourself what it looks like. And I did the same thing. I went to chapter 2, verse 13, chapter 2, verse 18, chapter 3, verse 1. And so you can see what submission looks like. But I'd also like to say, just as the shepherd submits to the chief priest, to the chief shepherd, so also the sheep submit to the shepherd. So it's very similar. And then I like my answer for part B. How is it possible for everyone to be submissive to one another? Well, you add a scoop of love, you add a scoop of humility, you shake well, and guess what? When you have love and humility, it all works.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's awesome in this letter how, basically for most of these questions, I was just like, well, look back at 1 Peter 1. There's, 10 verses there, 1 Peter 2, 1 Peter 3. Everything that Peter has said so far is built upon each other, and this is the capstone of the letter. And I think that's just awesome. Any other comments on this first question? Trace?
I was just going to say this verse is also quoted in James. James 6, or 4, verse 6. I won't read it because it says the same thing. But I like how Jesus says it in Matthew 23:12. And whoever exalts himself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted.
Very good. Beth?
Yeah, I like what everyone said. And Cole's mentioned the difference between all of us and then to God. It's so logarithmically that you can't be proud. And then another aspect of that is, what gift do you have that wasn't given you by God? People tend to have pride in their intelligence or their looks or whatever physical characteristic it is, but none of us did anything for those. Those were all given to us by God. And so to be proud, to not be humble, is ridiculous. And so I'm having the correct estimation of yourself is so key. And obviously God helps us to understand who we really are.
That's a very good point. I had Proverbs 22, verse 4, speaking of humility. By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. So we can see that humility is coupled with fearing the Lord. If you don't fear the Lord, you're not humble. Awesome.
On the subject of Christian humility, again, appreciate and agree with what's been said. And I think about humility a little bit. Just like Bart just said, we need to have the correct opinion of ourselves. We can't have an overinflated opinion. But that doesn't mean that we need to have low self-esteem. And I think we may get into, if you're really thinking about this and how can I be more humble, just like Cole said, it's not self-deprecation. It's not putting yourself down. And in fact, I think that's kind of where pride comes from. It comes from insecurity. It comes from a place where we're not actually secure in ourselves. And part of that humility is understanding who we are with God. And once we understand who we are with God, that God is the one that makes us whole, and that without Him, we're not enough, but we do have Him, so we are enough. So I think that's a little bit of what humility might lead to.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. But if there's anything that we should be proud of, it's that we're the image bearers of God. That's our duty here on this earth. And we shouldn't be prideful in vain things. But we should be prideful that we're able to serve the Lord God. Any other comments? If not, we'll move on to question number 2, which will be for you, Austin. Why is it important to humble ourselves to God? How are we going to be exalted? How do we cast our care upon Him? And why is it important to be able to cast our cares upon God?
So, again, kind of going back to the point of knowing who you are with God. And from the very beginning, I think we understand that that was Satan's problems, that he didn't understand who he was. And he tried to elevate himself towards God. And, of course, God cast him out as a result of that. And whenever we rebel against God, we're doing exactly what the devil did. So humility is understanding that God is greater than I. And once we understand that, and then we, of course, act that out in obedience to what he commands us to do and follow after his will and diligently seek out after him, that is us humbling ourselves to God. So all of that is very important to do so because of the exaltation that will happen. What kind of exaltation is that? I think it's going to be exactly what it talks about in verse 4 of this same chapter. You will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. It's talking about eternal reward. And the important thing is that we understand that exaltation is happening in due time. And furthermore, it's on God's timetable and not ours. So while we humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, while we submit to him, it's not going to feel like we're exalted at times. At times it's going to feel like we're the lowest of the low. And I think even Paul talks about that kind of extensively in 2 Corinthians, how they were just tossed aside. They were viewed as next to nothing, these types of things. But the exaltation is coming, and that's our hope, is that one day we will receive these things. Casting all your care upon him. How do we do that? I think we do that through prayer. It's a very good way to cast your care upon him. I think we see that exemplified in the Psalms. But also, it's the fact that we are trusting in God. And that's what humbling ourselves to God ultimately is that we cast our care upon him and say, there are things in this life that I can't handle, but you can. So I put them in your hands, and I take them out of mine. Instead of us worrying about them and stressing over things that we can't control.
Yeah, that's very good. Kind of similar to Levi's inverse ratio that he had in his lesson on Sunday, I had an equation. I said, casting your care is equal or equivalent to putting your faith in God's promise. Any other brother have a comment on this question? Bill?
I like part C, the word casting. That wasn't what I thought it was. We think of casting, we're throwing something, but this is more, the definition is more of a deposit. It's we're depositing something, we're casting it, we're depositing it. I thought about the widow's mite, how she cast her money into the treasury. But thinking of it as a deposit, to cast upon Jesus our cares. The problem isn't Jesus' ability to care for us, but our ability to trust Jesus with our cares. And to me, proof of that statement is how people continue to be overwhelmed, worried, and stressed over something they turned over to God. They said they turned it over to God. You deposited it with the Lord. Trust him. He'll take care of it. Don't be consumed by it. Don't continue to be consumed by it. And maybe a similar comparison might be when you ever apologize to someone and they even say that they forgive you, but they continue to bring it up. That might be a little bit how this works with casting your cares. You think you cast them on the Lord, but you still have them. You've not really trusted in the Lord. And it's like those people that you're asking to forgive. They say they forgive you, and they continue to bring it up. You gotta let go of the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate those comments. I noticed that the NIV translated cares as anxieties. And I like that translation. Cast your anxieties on God. Which especially applies to what the brethren are going through at this time. Any other brother have a comment? If not, we'll go ahead and go to question
number 3,
which will be for
Bill. What does it mean to be sober and to be vigilant? What are some of the similarities between the devil and a lion? How are we supposed to resist the devil? And how are these same sufferings experienced by the brotherhood in the world?
Well, what does it mean to be sober and vigilant? chapter 4, verse 7, be serious and watchful in your prayers. The end is coming. Serious and watchful are a couple other words similar to sober and vigilant. Vigilant. Part B, what are some similarities between the devil and a lion? Well, I thought that they're both powerful. They're both fast, and they both hunt their prey. Proverbs 30 and verse 30, the lion turns away from nothing. So the devil's not going to be afraid of anything, except maybe the Lord. Except the Lord. Part C, how are we supposed to resist the devil? By being steadfast in our faith. Ephesians 6, verse 16, the shield of faith is able to quench the darts of the wicked one. So we need our faith. We have to have our faith, and we have to have confidence in our faith. Part D, how are these same sufferings experienced by the brotherhood in the world? Well, you messed with me a little bit, Austin. Brotherhood in the world, I saw that as a contradiction, but I'm going to go with the brotherhood of the world approach, referring to mankind outside the family of God. Verse 9, the world isn't the physical world, but the ungodly multitude who have alienated themselves from God. Those afflictions that are resisted in faith are accomplished in our brethren of the world. They're not, they don't have the faith. They're not going to be there. They're not going to be able to, they're going to experience all these sufferings.
Thank you. Any other brother? Want to comment, Lauren?
So, part C, how are we supposed to resist the devil? I think we also see an example here from Jesus when he's tempted in the wilderness. He always goes back to "it is written." So this is resisting him in faith, but the power of God will overcome the devil. And in I think the context of this, you know, we have the devil as a roaring lion, so he's boisterous and trying to put fear in people, and that is a way to not give in to that fear. And then for part B, what are some of the similarities between the devil and the lion? So every Sunday night when I was a kid, we'd watch Usual Momonos, Wild Kingdom. And the lion is pretty well camouflaged, and he likes to pick off the wildy beast that is at the back of the herd, the sick and the weak. And he likes to pick those off that are away from the herd, too. So, you know, he takes advantage of whatever weakness he sees. But then for that last part about the sufferings experienced by the brotherhood in the world, I was wondering if Peter might not be thinking about what we see in John 16:33, these things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, that I have overcome the world. So what, you know, kind of the theme of this book is, in this life we will have some tribulation.
Very good. I liked your lion characteristics, because I went down a similar path. I thought of how lions are well camouflaged. They're ready to take out the weakest, the one who strays, and that made me think about James, because James lays out very plainly how sin works. God isn't the one who tempts you, it's your desires. And what do your desires do? They lure you away. They lure you away from the safe place, from the herd, from the church. And once you've been lured out, that's when Satan strikes, and that's what came to mind for me. Any other brother have a comment? Awesome.
So, I was kind of thinking about part A in a different context, and that would be when it comes to partaking of alcohol or recreational drugs. And the command to be sober and vigilant, I think, trumps all of those. Just on that alone, we can make a whole bunch of arguments elsewhere, but just the fact that Christians are commanded to be aware of their surroundings, I think, is very significant. And I like to use this illustration, helps me a little. What will we say takes more concentration or more alertness, driving a car or living the Christian life? I think most people would say living the Christian life. So if we don't even want one sip of alcohol for our driver, how much less should we want that as a Christian? And if we're really thinking about that, I think that that kind of takes out kind of the recreational and social uses of these things. To Lauren's point, I was kind of thinking about D under the impression of kind of what's been talked about over and over again is the suffering that's going to take place. And you're going to be persecuted. And you're going to be tried. And I think Bill made the point about how lions are boisterous, or anyway, someone made the point about how this is a roaring lion. He's big and he's loud and he's trying to devour. So that has all the earmarks of what the persecution was, the Neronian persecution of that particular time that they were probably facing. And I think it's even more interesting when you think about how he's trying to pick off the weak ones in that context. Would be trying to get them to deny Christ under severe persecution and torture and physical harm. So where all your possessions are taken away, where you're ostracized from the from your family and from society, and how much more how appropriate that is for what they're facing and how more important it is to overcome these things.
Yeah, I understood question D the same. I was thinking in terms of the suffering from the incoming Roman persecution. And I just like 1 Peter 4, 12 through 13. So I'll read the verse 12 of chapter 4. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though something strange has happened to you. So when the question asks, how are these same sufferings experienced? It's not strange. The brotherhood is facing the same thing. So you're not alone in the sufferings and the persecution you're about to face. Hold fast. Keep the faith. Any other brother have a comment before we move on to question number 4? If not, question number 4 will be for Hunter. And it is, how do these final words of encouragement help the brethren that are being written to, and how should they help us?
Well, to backtrack a little bit to that last question, since I was going to have four right now, it made me kind of alluded to it, but thinking about the whole lion dynamic, it's a lot easier for lions to pick people off when they're alone. Like when you go hiking, like one of the, if you're in the mountains, like for a mountain lion, buffalo, if you're like astronomically at a higher chance of being mauled by a mountain lion if you're alone, compared to if you're in the group. So for Christians who self-isolate, who tend to do things by themselves, that's a warning sign. Versus Christians, that sounds really bad. For us as a cohesive congregation, to reach out to those people and to maintain them within the group, I think is important. But that's for the prior question. So how do these final words of verses 10 and 11 help the brethren that are being written to? Really, I think, and how do they help us? I think it's kind of one of the same. I mean, they're being written to in this particular context of this impending persecution, this Neronian persecution, presumably, but I think they're just as applicable for us as well. Again, the God of all grace and calls to his eternal glory, refresh Jesus after he has suffered a while. It's a while could be, for them, their life, for a couple years, for us, it could be our entire lifespan. May perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. So there's the whole notion of Christian perfection is, it kind of gets into the weeds a little bit. But I think it's just a constant process of improvement and striving to be as close to Christ as we can be. Establish and settle, I think, are kind of one and the same, in that you have this firm foundation that you're immovable, that you're firm, and obviously strengthen. And so I think the theme here is you're going to go through these things, but on the other side you're going to come out stronger and you're going to be grounding Christian. And so, you know, for Christians back then, as for us today, I think the same applies. You know, whatever trials we go through throughout our lives, who knows what those will be. But if we look at them the right way, and if we stay faithful, then we will come out stronger Christians, more firm, more perfect, more Christ-like.
Very good. Just like James 1 says, take pride and be happy about your tribulations, because you come out more refined vessel. Any other brother? Bill?
I found another interesting word. The word perfect here in verse 10, it means to render fit through a process of proper arranging and ordering of things. And I found it very interesting that this same word is used with reference to fishermen who use this term in referring to the mending or the arranging of their nets, Matthew chapter 4, verse 21.
Interesting. Any other brother have a comment? If not, I do just want to read verse 10 again, because if you read that, you just don't feel happy. I don't know what's going on, but may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after suffered for a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle. It's a beautiful verse, and it's perhaps one of the most beautiful ways to end the letter of encouragement.
And those are all future tense.
Yeah. There's no one else. We'll go ahead and move on to question number 5, which will be for Dennis. What can these final verses indicate to us from a historical perspective, and what are some of the assumptions that are drawn about the book?
Well, I'm pretty sure my answer is probably a good correction. I really had a hard time understanding what direction you want to go. Part B, what the put some information like Silvanus, also called Silas, one of the men chosen to deliver the letter to the Jerusalem Council, to the Church of Antioch, and maybe about that, Acts 15, verse 22. And he accompanied Paul on the second missionary journey, Acts 15, 40, 18, 7, 8, chapter 18, verse 17. He's mentioned by Paul in Paul's salutation. Beginnings of 1 Thessalonians 1 and also 2 Thessalonians 1. He also wrote with Timothy at Corinth, 2 Corinthians 1:19. Now, Babylon is broadly understood by scholars to refer to Rome, as Israel was captive in Babylon. Really, they were, and now we are Christians, we were exiled. They were exiled in Rome, they were in a foreign land. And that's what happened. First part of that. What are some of the assumptions could be drawn from this book about them? Peter wrote the letter just before Emperor Nero began persecuting Christians in Rome throughout the empire. Also, I put Paul was martyred for his faith, and, showing that he was really practicing what he was preaching. He lived by what he wrote. For he was trying to be like Christ. And, world was ruled by Satan, who was Christ's enemy. And we need to be like them. They were in the first century. They were a small group of Christians who stood against persecution, and so we need to stand for our faith with patience and endurance.
Well, I feel like you did pretty good. You had more than I did. So, any other brother? I want to comment on question number 5. Dad?
I totally agree with everything Dennis said. It's interesting that Peter is in Rome here, indicated by the code word Babylon, and we discussed in our study a little bit, what's he doing here? And maybe somebody else knows better, but maybe he's there visiting people who've been arrested because of the Neronian persecution. Maybe he's visiting with a brother. Maybe Peter himself has been arrested. Most of the commentators did not seem to think that was the case. but he was martyred in 68, maybe 69, and most think his letter is 64, 65. So, but then the interesting part is that he's with Mark, and Mark is John Mark, who wrote the gospel. And so, when did, and most people think that Mark wrote the gospel with Peter's help. That's a very common thing, and I don't know all the, maybe Austin remembers all the backing for that. But most people say that Mark's gospel is essentially Mark and Peter's gospel. They worked on it together. And so it's interesting that he's in Rome with Mark, and maybe they're working on the gospel of Mark. I don't know, maybe Mark was out already. It is getting late now. It's in the mid-60s, and so maybe Mark had already written the gospel. But it's interesting to think that maybe they're working on the gospel, and then Peter takes the opportunity to write this. And Silvanus, by the way, as Dennis mentioned, Silas, he was the fellow with Paul after Paul said goodbye to Mark. Remember Mark? He sent Mark left during the missionary journey and went back to Jerusalem, and then Silas was the guy that went with the apostle on the missionary journey after Mark left. And so now you've got Peter, Mark, and Silas all together in Rome. And so it's just cool. It's, you know, we don't have much, you know, and it doesn't really matter what these individuals were doing. And we don't have much, but this suggests that these three individuals who had had a long history with the Apostle Paul are all in Rome, writing and working together. So just kind of, those are all assumptions, but kind of fun.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting and cool thought to think about. Any other brother have a question or an answer to the question? If not, we'll go ahead and move on to the last one
for tonight,
which will be for John. Should you
like it? What are some of the themes of the book of 1 Peter that mean the most to you after having gone through it?
Mainly what's staff do is suffering can be looked at differently than just as a negative thing if it is done for the right reasons to obtain salvation. The Lord, you know, stresses that he won't give us more than we can't resist as far as temptation goes, so we do have a way to get out of it each time. It's just we have to really want to. Also, humility is key in our daily lives as well as submission. It stresses the place several times. And then, our example to outsiders is important to consider because it could cost them their souls. So, you know, as they are new Christians, being kind of instructed on how they want, how they should set the foundation to move forward. It's like that applies to us directly today. Finally, salvation is something we work at daily. It's not something that's just, you know, we've obtained it and we just maintain it. We just kind of every day have to revisit what we already know to be true. So,
yeah. Very good, yeah. Like you said, I think suffering for Christ is not in vain. It's probably the main theme that Peter has written about in this book. And I've got a bunch of verses up there. I won't go ahead and read all of them, but a lot of beautiful passages of encouragement, especially 5:10, as I reread a little bit ago. There's a lot of great stuff here in 1 Peter. It's probably the best book on dealing with suffering, dealing with tribulation. James also does a pretty good job, but Peter does it the best. And then being submissive, I liked that theme as well, because it's not really one that you think too often about, being submissive to your elders. You know you're supposed to be submissive to the government, but when we talked about being submissive to elders, I really appreciated that topic, so I put that up there. Any other themes, Lauren?
Another theme we had kind of running in the background as an allegory in this was the connection of the Christian to the Old Testament, beginning in the, you know, at the very first with the pilgrims of the dispersion. And then, you know, in chapter 2, we had this, "Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts that war against the soul, and of being a special people, like the pilgrims." people of Israel were. Now, Christians are that. And then, you know, here in this very last bit, we have this kind of connection with the persecution of Nero and Rome to the Babylonian. So that theme runs throughout this book. It's,
yeah. That's really cool. I like that. I like that a lot. I've got just this theme page that I found. I thought it put everything pretty aptly of 1 Peter. Anyone else have any other comments before we close the service? Austin.
Just that one of the things that I appreciated more going through it this time was how frequently the church is brought up with the brethren. All of these things are talked about in a collective sense. It's you all. It's the brotherhood. You're a special people. This is how you need to treat your brethren. This is how you even came to Christ there in chapter 1 and in chapter 2. And even just what we were reading there here in this chapter, same sufferings experienced by your brotherhood in the world. So just the connection to the church universal and respect and understanding of that really stuck out to me this time that I didn't appreciate.
Yeah, the thought of that applying today, you know, who knows how many churches there are out there that we don't know exist, but we're still connected to them. Any other comments before we close?